Richard Damon is being interviewed by Renee Garowitz for Concord's Oral History Program. The interview is taking place at his home at 1623 Main Street on October 24, 1990. Mr. Damon is 67 years old. This house that once was 428 Main Street has always been lived in by Damon since it was built in 1884. It was your grandparents' home.
That's right. And my grandparents lived here. They had 12 children. My father was the sixth of those 12. And he grew up in this house. And after my grandmother died and my twin brothers were born to make the fourth and fifth sons in his family, we were crowded in the house we were in on Pleasant Street and moved here to 428 Main Street in 1931. He had Martin Hoyam primarily as the carpenter to overhaul the house. They changed the shingles, changed the color from dark green to light gray, replaced all the floors, updated the bathrooms and the kitchen, changed the heating system from registers with hot air to a convection hot water system, and generally brought the house into the 20th century. So I was 8 years old at that time, and lived here, grew up here, as did my brothers. And in fact, my father finally sold the house to me in 1963, when he built a house at 179 Prairie Street for himself and my mother. Where they both lived until they died. And I've been here now ever my wife and children ever since 1963. It's been a wonderful place. He had was taking care of the land around here from his grandmother's estate.
This is your father,
Ann Damon,
Winslow.
My father, Winslow. And Ann Damon's executors were my father's uncles, Will and Bob, but he was the one on the scene, and he took care of Hill Block, and he took care of the land around here, and sold it for them and rented Hill Block. And as his pay, sometime in the late 30s or early 40s, he received the land behind the house here and across the street. The land across the street he sold in about 1950. My brother Henry built a house over there, as well as two other houses. That was called the Valley Garden. The land behind the house he sold in the mid-50s, what was it used to be called the Cow Pasture, which is now Westvale Drive and Prairie Street. And a number of houses were built there. The land directly behind the house, he offered me an option on if I still lived here when he died, and I did, and so I exercised the option. And that's where we now have our blueberries and used to have a garden. He gardened it all the way back down to the blueberries, and he planted the blueberries. He was a very active gardener.
And your mother canned.
And my mother canned and the vegetables. And my father also maintained various animals. We had chickens, from which we got the eggs and the meat. He had would buy a pig or a lamb and have it slaughtered and kept it up at the deep freeze, Jenks deep freeze in West Acton. I had rabbits, both a dog and a cat, and my twin brothers, younger twin brothers, had goats and sold the goat milk. And we all had a busy time around here.
Both your parents were active in town affairs. Do you recall some of their contributions?
They were very active. My mother, who was born in Boston and then moved to Dedham, was the teacher in the Concord Public Schools, in the West Concord Schools. And I recall she told me that she rang the bell on Armistice Day 1918 in the Harvey Wheeler School. Also, while I was in the West Concord School, which has since been torn down, there was a drawing in colored chalk on one of the blackboards in the southeast corner of that school. And when I told her about it, she said, well, she had done that many years before, and nobody had erased it since that time.
Nobody had done it better.
Nobody had done it better.
Was that the picture of the rabbit?
Yes, it was a rabbit sitting under a tree. But she was president of the Women's Club twice. She was on the school committee for 9 years and chairman for five. At the time that they were planning and building the new schools, the Halkett, the Thoreau, and some of the other schools. And
so this is in the late 40s?
She was on the school committee, I believe, from 1943 to 52.
Mm-hmm.
And she was also a leader of the 4-H Club and taught us crafts. The Cub Scouts were formed after I was too old for them, but she was a den leader when my twin brothers were in the Cubs. My father was on the Board of Public Welfare for many years, from the mid-30s until 1952, I believe. And his real outside activity was the Masonic Lodge. He was the master of Corinthian Lodge in Concord. He was district deputy commander of the 12th Masonic District, which is headquartered in Lowell. He was in the Sir Galahad Commandery. He was in the chapter. And his activities were recognized when at their 50th anniversary in 1972, the Masonic Lodge dedicated a scholarship fund called the Winslow J. Damon Scholarship Fund, and presented him with the certificate endowing and started to endow that fund, and it's doing very well since that time.
Is for a local high school student?
It is not necessarily a local high school student, and most of the awardees have tended to be involved with DMLA or other Masonic activities, or their
mm-hmm.
parents were.
I see.
But that's not a requirement, it just mm-hmm. happens to come out that way.
You seem to have a very busy and contented childhood that's centered around the West Concord community. And some of your friends still live here today. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. Well, we had a wonderful time. I used to walk to school and met a number of friends there. And it's about 3/4 mile from here to the school. It took about 15 minutes. We came home for lunch. One of my closest friends was Bud Harmon, but I'm also good friends with Jim Condon, Barry Higgins, John Chase, Paul Boyd, just to name a few, and with the girls, Mary Laughlin, who's now Mary Smith, and my cousin Margaret Damon, and Bud Hyman's younger sister Mildred, and several others. We played a lot of sports after school. We generally played on the field that was in the old cow pasture at the end of Central Street and Brown Street. And we played baseball there, we played football there. We also played at the Percy Rideout playground.
On Lawsbrook.
On Lawsbrook Road. Percy Rideout, of course, was the twin brother of my high school English teacher, Gertrude Rideout,
mm-hmm.
who had been killed in World War I. And we played hockey on Warner's Pond primarily, skated also on Hatchop Pond, now Kennedy Pond. There used to be an ice house on Hatchop Pond. That disappeared about the time of World War II. I don't know how many people remember it, but it was a very active ice house, and they cut the ice on that pond.
Though your father was a leather salesman, he also was in the ice business for a time?
In the period before the First World War,
mm-hmm.
I'm told that he was an iceman around Concord, and a lot of people remember him because he was just a very likable person. Everybody knew the Iceman. He then joined the army in 1917 and was in several battles in France and was wounded and was thereafter very active in the American Legion, in
mm-hmm.
fact. He always played Santa Claus at the Legion's Christmas party. And, and yes, he was a leather salesman. He had a leather, he worked for E.R. Nash Company on South Street in Boston. and he bought the business in the early 30s, but he lost it during the Depression,
mm-hmm.
and worked for Cambridge Rubber Company, and then in the 40s, he and some friends formed the Seal Tanning Company and the Seal Sales Company,
mm-hmm.
and that was what he was with until he retired.
So your friends were a very close-knit group?
We had mm-hmm. a lot of close friends. A large number of children my age living down around Central Street, Francis Street, Prairie Street, Chase Road. Others down, Jim Condon lives in the house he grew up in on the corner of West Street and Main Street. And Woody Blocker, who was in our class, lived next door to him. The Harmons lived on Commonwealth Avenue, and Ed O'Neill and his brothers lived in the White Row. Elizabeth McNally and her brother lived on, in the Green Row. So we got together skating on Warner's Pond, for example, playing hockey, swimming at Libby's beach over on the north side of Warner's Pond.
Libby's Beach.
Libby's
Who
beach.
Was Libby?
So where Jeff Giroux, Ralph Giroux lives right now.
Mm-hmm.
And
was there a Libby?
No, I don't know who Libby was, but we always called it Libby's. And of course, we were very active in the Boy Scouts, all of us, most of us. And the West End Land Company had graciously let the Boy Scouts use an island in the middle of Warner's Pond. And we camped there a great deal, built a cabin there. Number of notes about carrying bricks from the mainland over to the island, or pushing them across on the ice to the island, and then carrying them up to the site of the cabin in the summertime.
No, it's cold.
We had some wonderful scout matches. Some of those whom I remember include Huck Graham, Sarge Rowan, George Rowan's father, Dr. Dow, Jim Denton, Horace Fletcher, and we went through them at a pretty good rate, but we had one or two a year. We went on a lot of hikes by patrols, on a 14-mile hike. We did tests together and went to Fairhaven Bay, went to a place that we called the Junipers over on Old Pickett Road at the boundary of Concord and Sudbury, and generally had an awfully good time in Scouts. Now, in 1937, there was a scout jamboree in Washington, and several of us wanted to go to that. Those that I remember were Bill McCarthy, Bud Harmon, my cousin Bob Damon, and me. We worked for about 6 months to raise the money to go. We did all kinds of things, from cleaning cellars, raking lawns, weeding gardens, washing windows. We generally got about 25 cents an hour, and as it turns out, that required about 8 hours of work a week for about 6 months to save the $50 we needed to go to the work down to Washington. We took the train out of Framingham and went down to Union Station, and then across to our campsite, which was just across the Memorial Bridge about where the Pentagon is now, and set up our tents and stayed there for, I think it was a week. We had a big convocation, and it was quite awe-inspiring to see about 15 or 20,000 scouts in one location. I remember standing out in the sun at 95 degrees waiting for President Franklin Roosevelt to drive by at 35 miles an hour, waving to us all. And,
that must have been inspiring.
Yeah. And we did a great deal of trading with boys from all over the country. The Waltham Watch Company had given us neckerchief slides with watches faces on them, and I remember trading them with boys from New Mexico and from Idaho and from Maine, and it was just a wonderful experience.
You also went to the World's Fair?
Yes, 2 years later, Bud Harmon and I went to the World's Fair. We stayed with my uncle, who was in the Navy at the Brooklyn Navy Yard at the time, and took the subway over from Brooklyn over to the Queens to go to the World's Fair. And I remember, some of what I remember in the Unisphere was the City of the Future model. That was exciting. And the RCA television exhibit. And when I was in graduate school 10 years later, I had to fix one of those television sets up for an experiment for the students.
And you were wearing your Boy Scout uniform?
Not at the World's Fair.
Not at the World's Fair.
Not at the World's Fair. I remember also, you know, Tommy Dorsey's band, for example, mm-hmm. and Dick Hames and Helen O'Connell singing. And it was generally an exciting time for both of Bud and me. We arrived back in Boston, set aside our train fare out to West Concord, bought an ice cream cone, and I arrived home with a dime in my pocket.
You actually kept diaries of your boyhood times in the 1930s.
I did for a few years. Some of them are better than others. In 1933, one I think I lasted through February or March or something, although I did generally put in the holidays later. And I had one also in 34 where I did somewhat better up until about August, and 36 and 38. So it covered me from 9 to about 15 years old.
In 1938, just looking at your diaries, I recalled your going to a football practice after school that was quite windy and wet, and you certainly had no idea what that day signified in September 21st, 1938.
That's right. That was September 21st, 1938, and that was the day of the famous New England hurricane. And my diary says, Wednesday, September 21st, 1938. After school, I went to football practice. And what practice it was. The wind was blowing so we could hardly stand up, and it was pouring. When I came home, the car couldn't get up Main Street because a tree was down. About 6, we had a real hurricane. One of Vino's chimneys went down, and both of Foley's. Foley's was next door, and Vino's was down by Conant Street. Four of our trees, one of Vino's went, and the exhibit across the street fell over. The light and telephone wires were down, too. So we used candles. All the town power is off. There are at least 50 cars out front as cars can't get past here to go to Maynard, for all the trees are down. It lasted till about 12 p.m. So that was an exciting time, and for the next several months, my brother Henry and I chopped or sawed and split wood. So.
And there was a great feeling of unity in this West Concord area.
It really was. We had I don't think anybody disliked anybody, and, mm-hmm. And we had a real unity of people who, the Boy Scouts was an example of the kind of group feeling we all had for being together.
Even before you were old enough to join the Boy Scouts, you formed your own little...
I wanted to join the Scouts, and I did in fact join them. I turned 12 on a Tuesday, and I joined the Boy Scouts on Friday when I was 12. But before that, I had wanted to join the Scouts, and I was too young, and there were no Cubs yet. So I formed an organization called the Society of Science, SOS. Mm-hmm. And it had quite a number of members. Woody Blocker was the president. Henry Harmon was the treasurer. I was the secretary. Then the members were Francis Ahern, Carl Anderson, Jim Condon, William Delfino, Mary Laughlin, now Mary Smith, Patricia Giroux, now Bergstrom, Priscilla Giroux, and I've got the minutes of 7 meetings from January 1934 to October 1934. And as an example, the fourth meeting, the SOS studied Mars. Everyone except Carl Anderson, Walter Murray, and the girls were there. Refreshments were served. The meeting was held at Richard Damon's house Friday, May 18th, 1934. The Treasury report said we had 7 cents. Respectively submitted by Secretary Richard Damon.
You had all the business organization, even though your treasury was small.
That's right. We had to do it right.
The church, the West Concord Union Church,
yes.
Played an important part in your family life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Stone was the minister at that time, although I didn't have much to do with him because that was for people who went to church. I was still in Sunday school. I remember some of my Sunday school teachers, for example, Brett McWilliams and Clarence Manter, Bill Robus, Lillian Miner, We went to Sunday school most every Sunday, along with many of my friends, my cousins, Bob and Margaret, the Harmons, the McCauleys from Francis Street, Paul Boyd. We had a good time at Sunday school, and then as we grew older, there was the Christian Endeavor, which met in the evening.
That was a society.
That's a society, yes. Basically, it was the youth organization.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall that in Christian Endeavor, we took at least one trip to Mount Monadnock, for example, for a day.
Mm-hmm.
And we had parties together, and it was quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
When I got into high school, we began to have parties without Christian Endeavor or Scouts
uh-huh.
or anything. We had a group of anywhere from 8 to 12 or so of us, varied by the week, who got together in each other's home almost every Saturday evening and listened to your hit parade and danced and talked and had some light refreshments. And, you know, we would go around, we'd have our dances here in this house or Bud Harmon's house or Margaret Damon's or Mary Laughlin's or Helen King over on Upland Road. And it was a good way for us kids to be together and have a good time.
A very wholesome fun.
Yeah.
And for young boys, there was always the paper route to earn money.
Well, we had I always had a job. Starting, I guess, in when I was about 10 or 11 years old, I had a magazine route. Saturday Evening Post, Ladies' Own Journal, Country Gentleman. And then I graduated as I got into, I think, about 15 years old, to a newspaper route, which is the Boston Herald Traveler. And I would pick the papers up in the morning at about 6:15 or 6:30, and my route went up Commonwealth Avenue to Assabet Avenue, across a shortcut across to what's the name of that road? Barrett's Mill Road, and then back down Commonwealth Avenue, out Lawsbrook Road, Conant Street, Main Street, and I even had a customer over on Harrington Avenue.
And you delivered twice.
And I delivered at 6:30 in the morning, and again I met the 5:12 train in the evening.
Amazing.
And at that time, Bud Harmon and Jim Condon and Herb Blodgett all had routes also, and so we would meet twice a day like that, picking up our papers and sorting them out and folding them, whatever we had to do. And also on Sundays, I delivered on Sundays too. And I delivered typically about 25 or 30 papers in the morning and about 60 in the evening and about 60 or 70 on Sundays. And I made $6 or $7 a week. I got 0.3 cents for each paper. And the papers cost 2 cents in the drugstore. So, and I charged 15 cents a week, so I made 3 cents a week for each delivery that way. I forget what I got on Sundays. I also collected, as I recall, 12 cents a week for insurance, and I don't know what the customer got for that insurance. It was a life insurance policy. And
had nothing to do with newspapers.
Had nothing to do with, the newspapers were selling the insurance,
yeah.
But
mm-hmm.
Had nothing to do with the newspapers. And it was good for about $6 or $7 a week.
Mm-hmm.
After my boss came around once a week, and he would collect from me. I would either give him the money or the dateline from the newspaper. And if somebody didn't pay me, I lost.
Mm-hmm.
And during the Depression, there were a few who led me on a few weeks.
You learned human nature.
I learned human nature, and I learned accounting.
And you...
And then I left that to go to work at a filling station on Thoreau's Bean Patch at the corner of Route 2 and Walden Street. And that was Mr. Dunn. And it was an Esso station. And I would pump gas, fill radiators, add oil, repair flaps. I would lubricate and change oil. And I got 25 cents an hour. And during vacation times, I worked as much as 80 hours a week. And during school times, it would be more like 40 hours a week. I rode my bicycle down there and back. I left there in the spring of 1941 to go to work for Adams and Bridges, which is a classical grocery store in West Concord across from the post office. It had the large pieces of cheese, from which I got skilled at cutting off a half pound when somebody asked for it. It had a Cracker Barrel. It had the canned and boxed goods were all up on a shelf to the ceiling, and used a clamp on the end of a long stick to pull it down for the customer. Of course, the customers didn't serve themselves. They had a clerk serving them. And so I would get what they wanted and then add up their bill on the brown paper sack in which they took their goods home. And the thing I liked about the job was, first of all, I only worked about 60 hours a week instead of 80. And I got paid $17 a week. And they had delivery, and I got to drive the car.
Uh-huh. That was the thrill.
That was the best part.
What is there now?
There's a video shop there.
Mm-hmm.
It's right next to Carl Hayes' shoe store.
I see.
And there was the Gail Mark shop was there for a while.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I see. There was another member of your family I know very well who kept diaries. Your great-grandfather,
yes.
Edward Damon, and the entire legacy of the Damon family begins with his father and the textile mill here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Calvin Damon, who was born in Amherst, New Hampshire, moved to Concord in 1834. He had come by way of Andover and Framingham and bought the mill at the site where it's now located, and ran it successfully as a woolen mill. He died in the 1850s, in his early 50s, and his son Edward, the oldest son Edward, who was then 17, left school. He had been at Phillips Andover, and came back to run the mill. And at 17, he did so successfully. About 6 or 7 years later, in 1862, the mill burned to the ground. Before it burned, we have a map, a survey done by Henry David Thoreau, showing the old mill that Calvin the wooden mill that Calvin and then Edward had owned. In 1862, Edward rebuilt the mill with of brick. 5 stories high. It's subsequently added on 1 story and a couple of wings since he built it. And I think it's in the obituary by his cousin Henry Smith, that when Edwards was building the canal, he was accused of spending too much time building it, and he said, "I'm going to do this right so my children don't have to do it again."
That's in the Social Circle memoirs.
That's right, in the Social Circle memoirs.
Of which great-grandfather was also...
Well, he was a member of the Social Circle, mm-hmm. along with Ralph Waldo Emerson and others. He ran the mill, again successfully, with various names and partners into the 1890s. In 1893, he took in his son, Ralph, as president, and Edward became chairman. At that time, Edward was also made president of the Concord National Bank. However, he had a mortgage on the mill from the Middlesex Institution for Savings, and in 1898, they were unable to meet the mortgage, and the bank foreclosed on them. And it was then sold to another woolen company, ultimately what became the American Woolen Company, I believe, and they moved most of the equipment out of that mill up to Maynard, where they operated for many years. This ran as a textile mill until the early 1920s, about 1922, which is when that equipment was moved out. And then it became a warehouse for the A&P, and in the early 30s, Jack Lord of Stowe bought the mill and made it into an apple cold storage plant. He ran that until 1970. And it was a busy place. There were a lot of trucks full of apples pulling in there all the time during my youth. And the number of people around here worked there. I never did. In 1970, Jack Lord sold it, and it went through 3 successive hands. until finally in 1977, Bill Sullivan told me over the fence that the
mill was your next door neighbor.
Who was my next door neighbor at the time,
mm-hmm.
told me that it was going to be up for auction soon. And I had just been looking at an apartment property that I might purchase, and it had just fallen through, and so I happened to have a little bit of money. So we got together, and Bill propositioned one of the previous owners to take back a mortgage on it, and we acquired the mill with caved-in roof, the top two floors decayed, all the windows broken, the north end of the building, the stone, the brick walls falling in, and it was quite a mess. I think anybody in their right mind would never have considered it. But
you believe because it was part of your life.
We both loved it. We both loved it. I had been down there 3 or 4 years before that taking photographs, because it was clear it was going to go, of the architectural details, the rods going across, holding it stiffly in place, the granite around the deep desire to make something out of that. And
you did.
And it happened, although there were some awfully touchy moments. He just worked terribly hard. He worked 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. He did everything from cleaning out the muck in the canal or in the cellar to doing the creative planning of what we could do with it. We had quite a number of... we started out just getting people in there for warehousing, people like Data Terminal Systems and Echos, which is run by Dave Del Porto and his wife Alva, Ken Erickson, who made exhibits, Glenn Olson, son of Ken Olson, was there with the Moose River Pitchfork Company for a while, Chucky Harmon was doing house insulation, Don Spigarelli had Hybrid Technology Corporation down there. Pat Thornton is an industrial designer. We had Neshoba Winery there with Jack Partridge and Chip Carpenter, who made custom furniture. And it was an exciting time. But it did take us until 1984 before Bill Sullivan finally put it all together, 7 years, and got enough people to commit themselves to purchase condominiums or long-term leases so that we were able to get the financing to renovate the building. So that happened in 1984.
So you stood by and watched the phoenix rise from the ashes.
That's right. We both did. We were, there were times when we were concerned. It took some more transfusions of money and time and effort, and we didn't think it would be that long. But it's been very satisfying. I understand there are about 300 people employed down there now, and 20 or so different companies. It's a lot of fun and a lot of satisfaction.
And so the Damon legacy continues in the name of the complex.
That's true. Bill suggested the name, Damon Mill Square, and it was very nice of him, and people seem to accept that.
Thank you.